The lack of imagination of this man, who could have gone to his colleagues and asked for literally anything on behalf of his constituents in West Virginia and probably would have gotten it.
Ladies and gentlemen, Mary Small. Oh my God, Mary.
I'm sorry, y'all.
Hello, I'm Guido Gergenti, and you're listening to Block Party, a show about what the left does or doesn't do in American politics, what it might do, why progressive politicians and grassroots organizers are losing or winning. Also a show about why things keep getting worse in the United States of America, what the consequences of this broken-ass political system are, and investigations into whether anyone has the power to do anything about it. Today, we assess what went wrong, like in the past 14 months with Biden's domestic agenda, not like in all of American history. We're going to take it one step at a time. What went wrong with the incredibly convoluted saga of the Democratic agenda formerly known as Build Back Better? Could the block of progressive representatives have played their hand any differently last year? Did Build Back Better really die on that dark, dark Friday, November 11th, when the House of Representatives failed to hold the line and passed the bipartisan infrastructure package? Or was it dead well before then? And if so, what were the key moments? Did progressives fuck it up? Did Pelosi and Schumer fuck it up? When? How? Gotta set the record straight before we move on to bigger questions. All that and more on group chat after a break. And today we have a returning guest from season one. It's Mary Small, who avid listeners might remember from right after Biden passed the American Rescue Plan in March 21. Mary Small is the National Legislative Director of Indivisible. Mary, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great. It's good to be back.
Thanks for coming. And of course, you just heard her, my co-host, Justice Democrats political director, Amir Hassan, who's already left D.C. in spirit, hanging out with Justice Democrats candidates across the country. Amir, how are you doing today?
I'm doing okay. I think I'm feeling very reflective because I got done listening to the episode from last year. And wow, what different vibes. Just very, very different vibe. So hopeful, so optimistic, so joyful. You know, March 2021, different worlds. We're living in different worlds.
I understand it feels like a distant memory. So to jog all of our memories, including you listeners at home, let's rewind to Mary and Amira on group chat reacting to Congress passing through budget reconciliation Biden's American Rescue Plan.
The American Rescue Plan that will tackle the pandemic and get direct financial assistance and relief to Americans who need it the most.
Biden's $1.9 trillion American Rescue Plan included the expanded child tax credit, stimulus checks, aid to state and local governments that were struggling. And Mary and Amira showed up to group chat surprised in some ways that it hadn't gotten cut down and gutted more in negotiations. For one thing, budget reconciliation itself, as Mary reminded us, is a tool of neoliberalism.
Let's just like back up for a quick second.
Yeah.
This whole thing moved through reconciliation. They moved this through reconciliation, and reconciliation is a tool of austerity. That legislative pathway was created to force cuts in government spending. And so what progressives are trying to do right now is hijack a process that was created for austerity for government investment.
Team Biden's initial proposal was $1.9 trillion. No one knew what kind of legislative strategy they were going to attempt. And Amira was scared.
Nobody knew what track they were going to take. There was a bipartisan working group that was trying to put together their version of a COVID relief package. And
this included Manchin and moderate GOP senators.
Correct. Yes.
Quote unquote moderate.
Quote unquote moderates all working together, putting their brains together to see what they could come up with. And I'm pretty sure it was somewhere around the $800 billion mark.
basically halved. And within that, it was definitely excluding a lot of priorities that we were fighting for.
But a $1.9 trillion rescue package did pass. The bipartisan gang did not manage to cut it down. Stimulus checks were not cut out of the package. Mary, Amira, how do you look back on that optimism now?
I mean, I do think it was encouraging to, you know, back in March to see this new president and new Congress bust out with their first big package being ones that they moved on partisan lines, not getting held up in these like false negotiations. I mean, but this has been the rest of the year, right? But in March, they didn't get held up in these bad faith negotiations with Republicans where they were chasing folks who...
On both substance and strategy. Right. You were like, Biden White House is a little bit more impressive. You know, February, March 2021.
And then immediately, right, we have the president turn around and structure this two-track path for the rest of his legislative agenda. Part of it moving, on a bipartisan basis. The infrastructure piece, and then the other part supposedly moving on a partisan basis. And so much of the gridlock of bad faith negotiations that we thought were not where we were headed in March of 2021 turned out to be exactly where we were headed for a long time.
Yeah, that is definitely the big picture difference, the optimism for the future of what the Biden administration, the path they could have chosen, felt more realistic at that point, right? Because they just got done doing this partisan package and it had all this good stuff and we felt really hopeful.
But even then, just for the record, if we rewind, you were already worried.
I mean, I'm always worried. I think we should stay worried.
Okay, that's right.
You'll have President Biden, Joe Manchin be like, the next bill, the next thing we're doing has to be bipartisan.
Right.
This was a special exemption, but the next thing that we're going to do is going to be different. So,
yeah,
stay
totally.
Worried.
The like wielding their power thing is a baby muscle for the Democrats. So, like, good on them for doing it, but it is a baby muscle. And so, like, we got to be really sharp about, I don't know what the metaphor is here, like, continuing to force protein shakes on them or something to, like, work that muscle so that we can continue to see it over the course of this legislative session.
Mary's just, like, yelling at Joe Biden in the gym. It's like, you can do it. You have 50 votes.
In hindsight, we know what they obviously did. And I guess that baby, you know, building that baby muscle Mary talked about last time around, it atrophied. It never got built.
Could anything have gone differently, whether it was choices that Team Biden, Democratic leadership, Pelosi, Schumer, Budget Chairman Bernie Sanders, could they have made different choices? Could the left, the squad, the Congressional Progressive Caucus have made different choices that would have mattered? We're going to go through the key turning points and see what you think. Key turning point number one, early April 2021, following the passage of the American Rescue Plan, Team Biden has to make a decision about how to roll out their Build Back Better agenda.
I will lay out my Build Back Better recovery plan. It'll make historic investments in infrastructure, that Build Back Better plan. Infrastructure, manufacturing, innovation.
March into April, Congressional Progressive Caucus Chair Congresswoman Jayapal sends out a statement saying our preference is for a single ambitious package that would include both physical infrastructure and care infrastructure. These investments go hand in hand. Pelosi comes out publicly disagreeing with Pramila Jayapal, saying she thinks that Build Back Better should be split into one proposal focused on physical hard infrastructure and a second proposal focused on the family, care, and education policies, the, quote, social infrastructure. And Biden does just that with his announcement of the jobs plan and the families plan. We know that this is the process that's ultimately going to lead to the bipartisan infrastructure framework. Before we get to that, Amira, Mary, could the left have done anything differently this early in the process to get a different outcome?
I think about this particular period a lot, interrogating what could have been done different and where maybe progressives were too accepting of this split or in this bipartisan negotiation. I think that we all felt that, okay, like Manchin is saying that this is what he requires to move forward on any other big packages. The next thing has to be bipartisan. I think that was the general, from my recollection, from what I remember, that was the general idea. Like, okay, let Manchin have these negotiations. Let him have his little gang of whatever. Let them, you know, talk through these deals. And I remember there was a lot of, you know, times where Susan Collins was in and now she's out. And now, you know, there was a lot of just like wasting time. And, you know, who wants to even remember all of that?
Yeah, I mean, you and I have talked about this. I also have a hard time knowing exactly what we should have done differently at that time. I do think it probably matters that on the Democratic or the Democrats plus so-called Democrats side, this was Kyrsten Sinema's baby, right? Like she was the one who was the convener for a lot of the negotiations. I mean, part of me wonders if some of the dynamics that played out between her and Manchin were affected by him not seeing the bipartisan package as thoroughly his as she did in terms of seeing it hers or asking for changes. But I think the thing that we can't lose track of is that the reason that Republicans went along with that negotiation is because they thought that the bipartisan infrastructure package was the pressure release valve that mm-hmm. was going to make it so Democrats couldn't pass their big social spending bill. Mm-hmm. Well, mm-hmm. who's the joke on now? But that was the calculus, right? Like the reason that they were willing to engage in that is because they thought that that would blunt the momentum for the bigger bill.
And it did.
Yeah. So part of me wonders. yeah, exactly. And so I wonder if like there was a pathway to call that the whole strategy before Biff passed the Senate.
Womp, womp, womp.
I think both of you are right that both at the time and I think in retrospect, people haven't had a feeling of we just did a partisan vote on COVID. So now you have to give the other wing of the party this bipartisan thing. And it was very clearly part of the like the messaging as well, like in the AJP rollout on that April day, Biden is he's inviting it. He's excited about it.
Democrats and Republicans will have ideas about what they like and what they don't like about our plan. That's a good thing. That's the American way. That's the way democracy works. Debate is welcome. Compromise is inevitable. Changes are certain. In the next few weeks, the Vice President and I will be meeting with Republicans and Democrats to hear from everyone. And we'll be listening. We'll be open to good ideas and good faith negotiations. But here's what we won't be open to. We will not be open to doing nothing. Inaction simply is not an option.
Wow. Honestly, now having listened to that first clip, I'm like, wow, never mind. I should give everybody A pluses for taking BBB as far as we did. In retrospect, listening to President Biden, I'm like, wow, we never stood a chance. We were delusional, but that delusion carried us far. Good job, team. Good job.
You know, we're going to move on to the hostage situation because I think that's obviously where there's a lot more flexing. But that's maybe a hot take that I'll stand up for and see what you think. I'm like, this is where we lost. Like, spoiler alert.
True.
You know,
true.
We're going to go through some plays in the rest of 21 to, you know, like, learn about block tactics and, like, this whole new project and theory of change. But in terms of straight-up BBB, Biff, like, looking back on it, I'm like, maybe Jayapal was right in that late March statement. Like, that was it. It was sort of like, we're either going to do this all at once and we're going to find a way to, like, twist votes on that, or you're going to do this bipartisan play and it's over, basically, for all of, like, it's over. Because you're just, you don't realize how much time you're going to lose. Like, it's just, yeah, I don't know. That's when we lost. Mary and Mary, do you disagree? Is that the moment we lost?
I don't think that I agree with that. I think that that is the moment where our chances went from pretty good to pretty bad. But I don't think we lost the full thing. I think at the moment that President Biden decided to proceed in that way, the hand that progressives had to work with became incredibly shitty. But I don't think that we lost the full game at that point. I still think that there was a pathway. It was just really, really fucking slim.
Mm-hmm. So through April, May, and June of 2021, as this bipartisan gang and the Biden administration are negotiating what ultimately becomes the bipartisan infrastructure framework, the bipartisan infrastructure package, mostly a roads and bridges bill, what is the left doing? Since it is not attempting to blow up the bipartisan negotiation process, and it has assurances that
the 2022 fiscal year budget reconciliation is going to be used for the rest of Build Back Better, what is the left doing then?
I mean, back as BIF was happening in the Senate, progressives had figured out what their priorities were going to be for the social spending package when it moved. They were spending a good part of the spring getting themselves organized. Like we talked about last time, that one of the things that progressives have repeatedly done in the past, everyone is working on their own individual progressive issue, all of which are good and worthy, but it has the effect of fracturing progressive power pretty dramatically. Among progressives in the House, anyway, a lot of energy over the spring was spent getting themselves organized around their own top priorities and getting members whose top priorities didn't make it into the top list to support the whole slate. So there was a bunch of that internal organizing that was happening. And if I recall, I mean, Amira, tell me if you remember this differently, but there was kind of continued pressure around what the top line number for that budget resolution was going to be, to have it be as high as possible, and some ping-ponging back and forth between like statements from progressives in the House and then Chairman Bernie Sanders, and then going back and forth as that number kind of came down. And then a lot of committee level work to try to make sure that the actual legislative text that was moving through the House was good and strong. But you know, it's interesting, like I remember back when the progressives came out with their priorities for Build Back Better. I mean, we talked about the fact that it would be a gigantic win if we got through the budget resolution phase with all of those still intact. So remember, budget reconciliation happens in two phases because it is dumb and designed for austerity. The first one is a budget resolution. The second phase is a budget reconciliation. The first phase is just a shell. And then they do another whole round of votes where they fill in the shell. And I remember we thought we were going to have knocked it out of the park if all of our priorities were still in this shell, never mind the filled in package after that. And we came through the budget resolution with all of our stuff still in the shell. So even with a worse hand having been dealt to us by the president's choice to break these things apart, even after Senate progressives decided to support the bipartisan package, even after the number came down quite a lot, like there are ways in which we lost, but there were also ways in which we exceeded our own expectations for what was possible. If you think about heading even into the summer, do you have a different take, Amira?
Not one for the podcast. No, go ahead.
Was that too hopeful for your heart? Did your brain just break?
No, really, it was a little bit. Yeah, to be very honest. I was like,
damn. Ooh.
I was like looking back as you said everything. I was like, yeah, like scrambling. Everybody was scrambling to get the Bernie plan and it dropped and we were all like looking at it and we're all reading through it. And I was like, wow, all of that. But that was a good take. I don't disagree in the public. Eye on this.
All right. Well, Mary got us into the next key turning point, I would say, which is June 2021. Biden announces that there is a deal that this bipartisan group can agree on. We get the bipartisan infrastructure framework, and then he tells us very publicly what the insiders have known for a while. The rest of the agenda is going to go through reconciliation.
Republicans and this group did not want to go along with any of my family plan issues, the child care tax credits, the human infrastructure that I talk about. And that we'll see what happens in a reconciliation bill in the budget process. If that, if we get some compromise there, and if we can't, see if I can attract all the Democrats to a position that is there. But they're going to move in a dual track. And that's all I'll have to say. But I want to thank each and every one of them.
What are other Democratic leaders and the left doing at this time? Could they have done anything differently? As Mary mentioned, Senate Budget Chairman Bernie Sanders and Senate Democratic Majority Leader Chuck Schumer float a $6 trillion budget this same June. The assumption is over the summer, Democrats are going to put the meat on the bones of a budget resolution while the bipartisan infrastructure framework moves through the Senate, becomes legislation, and ultimately passes the Senate on August 10th. Amira, Mary, could anyone from any wing of the party done anything different?
I mean, I look back and I'm like, okay, could Senate Democrats have done something? Could Senate progressives have done something differently to have led us to a different place? Because we just completely let mansions of the world dictate that infrastructure package. We basically were, all our eyes were really focused and trained on this bigger reconciliation package. And I'm like, should we have just spent much more time also trying to meddle and have a hand in this BIF universe? I don't know, Mary, what do you think?
The way that Senate progressives ended up kind of blessing the BIF by voting for it as it was going through the Senate, not raising any really serious amendments or substantive objections to what was in the package, certainly made House progressives feel like they had more of an uphill battle in terms of contesting it.
All right, the timeline is moving along. Congress returns from August recess in September 2021, the Senate having passed the bipartisan infrastructure package on August 10th. Now, initially, back in June, when this two-track process was announced, there were implicit, sometimes explicit, confirmations from Team Biden, Pelosi, Schumer, that all of the Democratic Party was united in saying, we got to pass these two things together. And the argument, of course, from progressives was, if you pass the bipartisan infrastructure package and tell yourself you're going to negotiate Build Back Better later, you actually lose all of your leverage over the moderates and conservatives holding back the agenda. At the same time, you have conservative Democrats arguing that we should just pass the bipartisan infrastructure package ASAP. And by the end of September, Speaker Pelosi does indeed begin to make moves to bring the bipartisan infrastructure package to a vote in the House.
President Biden canceled a trip to Chicago today so he can stay in Washington, D.C. as crucial negotiations continue on the bipartisan infrastructure deal and the Build Back Better Act. House progressives are saying they will hold the line and oppose the $1 trillion infrastructure bill after House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said she would seek a vote Thursday on the measure without a commitment to also pass the Build Back Better Act.
Now, we don't have an exact vote count of how many House progressives were really willing to hold the line that September 30th, aka to vote no on BIF, to vote it down, to maintain the leverage to get BBB through. We don't have that vote count because Pelosi pulled the vote.
Speaker Nancy Pelosi, after a full day of talks with the president and members of Congress, unable to bridge the gap between moderates and progressives in her party.
So she delayed the vote on a $1.2 trillion bipartisan infrastructure bill because progressives vowed to vote it down without a firm agreement on President Biden's larger cradle-to-grave economic package.
We fly high, no lie, you know it. We were feeling ecstatic. Okay, listen, the block. First of all, these people whipped.
Mary, as we were approaching the first real test of the progressive block strategy, how confident were you that they were going to hold the line?
I mean, I don't recall an exact moment through the summer where I was like, for sure we're going to hold. But there was nonstop sustained organizing happening on the inside and on the outside for that whole period. I think, man, this is like a theme throughout this whole conversation. Like, how you feel about something depends on what you're comparing it to. If you're comparing it to the level of like muscular progressive infrastructure that we all wish that we had in Congress and we wish it already freaking existed already and that people were good at building that muscle, that we didn't have baby muscles that we had to build from scratch, but they were already like, I don't know, full bodybuilder muscles, then it was really, really frustrating and slow going. But if your comparison point is like, this was a new theory of change that most of the progressive caucus like wasn't familiar with until 6 months before that. And they did a few soft blocks over the course of the American Rescue Plan, but this was the first time that they were going to do a hard block, like be prepared to actually vote no on the House floor. If you think of it in those terms, like, of course it required a huge amount of organizing. Of course people were skittish and nervous.
Just to be clear about the tactics, like the soft block during the American Rescue Plan is when the text is still being negotiated in the Senate around stimulus checks, or, you know, are they going to be cut down? And basically the House is saying, it's not actually coming to a vote, but they're saying, no, that's not okay, versus a hard block of like, we're really ready to vote no.
Yeah, exactly right. And we were also all of us were working to build a much bigger block for this, like, hold the line that ended up happening in September than we had before. Like, we were in the high 60s of people who were part of that original, on the first hold of hold the line, of folks who were prepared to do that. And for a caucus that didn't have that level of discipline or the infrastructure to support it, or frankly, the trust in each other, that when it came down to the actual vote, that people would follow through with what they were saying, like, that's actually a pretty incredible organizing victory. Honestly, one of the moments I remember is that we had been doing whipping on the outside, they were doing whipping on the inside. We were trying to get this block to be as firm and solid as possible headed into this showdown. And a crew of us on the outside were having a conversation one day and saying, is there anything that we can do to make it just one step harder for the block to break? And there was a crew of people who said, what we can do is actually have a crew of activists outside at the Capitol cheering them on, saying, thank you for holding the line. Thank you for being the progressive champions that we deserve. And the thing that we can do on the outside that will make it just a little bit harder for them to flip and change their mind is to then have to walk out to a crowd of people that had their backs, that they disappointed. And I remember having that conversation. And when we started telling members of Congress that we were going to do it, and they were saying, yes, yes, do that, especially the left flank, especially the most progressive members of the caucus. That's the moment where I thought, oh my God, we're really going to do this. This is really going to happen. And at the same time, like, I don't know, Amira, my heart was in my throat until they actually called it. Like, I wasn't for sure until they actually called it. I don't know how you were feeling that night.
Even that, like, your heart was in your throat that first time, that last September week of, like,
we just never done it before. And I think if you're not nervous as hell the first time that you do something, well, I don't know, maybe there are people who go with that level of confidence, but I'm not one of those. I couldn't pull that off.
I mean, I think I agree for the most part. I think I was less nervous the first time around. And I look back, and Mary, we've talked about this a bunch too, just the political context at the moment with having the validation and the, you know, the silent blessing of Pelosi at the time and Biden and, you know, other Democrats who were like, yeah, like, you know, even if we're not part of this bloc, like, in general, like, this makes sense, right? Like, having had that actual, like, no real pushback, there was no, like, backs against the wall, like, you have to go and vote for this. Like, it was very, that first time around felt great, and I was so happy. And I think, yes, a lot of credit to the organizing and the work that was done, but it was also, there was no full test of people and, like, their stance and their commitment to this theory. But that changed, I think, the second time around, right? Which I wanted to give people credit to, because the second time around, when folks held the line on not voting for Biff, Pelosi.
This is late October, before Biden is heading to the UN climate conference in Glasgow, Scotland. They want to pass Biff again. Mm-hmm. They do the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the second holding of the line.
So the president will be heading to Italy and Scotland in a few days for conferences addressing climate change. Unfortunately for optics, however, climate change, or at least the piece of his spending package that's supposed to address climate change, looks like it's one of the pieces that may be on the chopping block as Democrats, you know, hash out what will finally be in that social spending bill.
President Biden went to the Hill. Like, I mean, they do a big, big push to get this done because they want to give him something to talk about and celebrate for him when he's in Glasgow. And progressives hold the line despite Speaker Pelosi making an explicit ask of them to, like, actually vote for it, but the president doesn't. So this time around, they were tested. There was a lot more pressure for people to vote for Biff, and the bloc did shrink a decent amount, but people held. And I think that, to me, is a true testament of the theory that, like, a lot of good organizing and work, and people can be committed to this theory enough, at least, for, you know, to buck leadership, which is big, which I don't think the caucus had ever done before. And I feel like that was a real, like, good moment to celebrate for me. I'll give people credit, full credit for that one. It was hard.
I think what, you know, you're saying, Mary, about your vantage point really matters a lot when you're in the trenches in D.C. You can actually, like, see how contingent the bloc's strength is, and you're like, oh, in June, we're actually really organized because we've done a lot of prep. And then in September, we're ready to hold the line. But then, as we know, Biff passes the House on that dark, dark Friday, November 5th. And I guess now I'm seeing the blocks, the contingency of block power from both sides, where it's like, did it just crumble in 3 weeks? Like, what happened?
I mean, one of the things that we talked about early on, I mean, even when the Congressional Progressive Caucus was restructuring the caucus in order to be, like, a little more able to pull off a voting block, one of the things that we talked about at the very beginning was that blocks atrophy over time, and that as the threats against a block escalate, the size of the block will atrophy. And I think that ended up being really true. I mean, what Amira said, that, like, the size of the block decreased the second time and then dramatically so on the third go round, was not sort of, like, outside of how we thought this model worked, but ended up being harder to overcome from an organizing perspective than we certainly hoped at the time. I think part of this comes down to a muscle that we have to build to be stronger for next time. But part of it also comes down to the difficulty of a progressive voting bloc. I mean, listening back to the podcast conversation with Ruth Block Rubin, talking about how the two biggest risks of a voting bloc are vote shopping and gridlock. And
what's vote shopping in that context mean?
It's like the ability of leadership to go shopping across the aisle for votes to make up for the votes they're losing on their flanks.
I see, yes.
So it's a risk of voting blocks on the extremes that voting blocks in the center don't have. And then gridlock. And so if you think about like the Freedom Caucus, gridlock was fine with them. And so they were happy to tank bills. That's not true for us. For like the Blue Dogs, or even just the situation that we have right now with Manchin, vote shopping isn't a problem for them because whatever concessions you would make to get the next Republican over are basically the same concessions you would make to get Manchin in many cases. And gridlock's also fine with him. And I think that part of the reason that progressives were unable to hold the block when faced with direct pressure from President Biden is because they got spooked that they were about to tip over into gridlock. It turns out that's where we're at anyway. Right, where we're at anyway is not delivering on Build Back Better, which is the whole reason that we wanted a voting block in the first place that tied Biff to actually passing Build Back Better. But I do think that it really revealed some of the weaknesses in alignment around strategy across a huge caucus.
I think it's interesting that you're describing the current situation as gridlock because I don't think anybody else would describe it as such.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. That's not how anyone is talking about Build Back Better. Right, or like whatever the version of that that's being negotiated with Manchin is right now.
I also think that a big part of why I think it's dead is because it's being negotiated so behind the scenes. Like there's no energy behind it. There's no attention being put on whatever may or may not survive the Senate or may or may not happen. Like with BBB, at least there was constant attention. The two-track strategy, there were it was juicy for DC media. There was tension. There was moderates. There was progressives. In reality, it's just like, you know, progressives versus big pharma. Like, I always want to be, like, very sure that the real people, like, blocking everything through their, you know, folks who are elected, but it is definitely big pharma. It is the lobby shops that are doing a lot of this, and I don't ever want to lose sight of that because it's not really progressives versus mods. It's progressives versus all these corporations and corporate interests, and that is the reality because I'm like, yeah, like it's genuinely embarrassing. I get so embarrassed every time I think about the fact that we are not lowering prescription drug prices. The shame of it 100%. Is just unbearable.
Well, and even in the like whatever the behind the scenes negotiations are that are happening with Manchin right now, and whether or not the climate provisions are going to be toxic, whether or not they're actually going to be pro fossil fuel, is about big oil, right? It's about fossil fuel executives and the degree to which Manchin is beholden to them. So for sure.
I mean, obviously that's true. I can't even talk about that anymore. I want to, like, before we go, make sure we, for the record, put our key lessons learned about these actors in Democratic politics and the dialectic between how much power progressives can build when and what Team Biden, the White House, Republicans choose to do. I'll start with the CPC. You brought up Professor Ruth Block Rubin, Mary. One take she gave in that podcast about the CPC, or just generally about blocks, was a big decision you make is size. And if you have a big block with a lot of members, in some ways the strategy that inclines you towards is this block actually represents the soul of the party. Like, we are actually representing the base and you should do what we want to do. And in some ways I felt like the CPC was actually pulling that off basically for as long as Pelosi and Biden were backing up two-track.
Well, not so my amendment to that is like not Pelosi, because Pelosi backed away a little bit on the first hold, far more on the second hold. But the problem for Biden's actually what really got to them. Right. And there's like an internal logic to it that I've thought about a lot, because I agree with her that like if you're talking about a big block, it makes more sense to frame it as like really representing the soul of the party or the center of gravity of the caucus or however the majority opinion, however it is that you want to frame it. But progressives' messaging all throughout was like, we are the ones who are making sure President Biden's agenda gets through Congress. There was like an explicit rhetorical connection to President Biden's legislative agenda and how they were the ones who had a strategy to deliver it. That, I mean, for starters, was true. They were the only ones who had a strategy to actually deliver Build Back Better once Biff moved through the Senate. But I do think that once you've hooked your strategy to, we're just trying to help out President Biden, when President Biden turns on the strategy, it leaves you in a lurch. And so I think that that's, given all of that, it's pretty predictable, actually, that when President Biden turned on the strategy, things got much more complicated for the bloc. So
yes, exactly. Yeah. But in some ways, and this is what Ruth was also getting to, where it's like there's been a tension in the CPC strategy the whole time because the CPC is trying to play both roles. You both want to have so many members that you can convincingly, that you can persuade the president, the media, and everybody, yeah, you really should do what they're doing. Like, they represent the base of the party. And you need to do organizing that makes some set of people disciplined enough, committed enough, down for it enough, trusting of each other enough that even under threat, 20 of them are going to vote no or whatever. And it's hard to do both. That's at least my takeaway thinking back from Ruth and looking at the CPC the past year.
I mean, the one place where I disagree with that is that I think you have to take vote shopping. So this idea that if a small number of progressives break off on the left flank, that leadership will then go look for votes across the aisle with moderate, so-called moderate Republicans, pretty seriously. And on the Biff vote, that was a super live dynamic. We did.
I mean, that is actually what happened.
Yeah, you know,
that 13 Republicans voted for Biff.
And they were able to find enough Republicans to get it across the finish line. And I suspect that if it had been close, they would have cut loose more Republicans to help it pass. That's a take that not everyone agrees with. You think that
Is they Republican leadership? Who's they would have cut loose more Republicans to help
Republican
it pass?
Leadership.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Because that is just a dynamic that's not true for the centrist voting blocks. So I agree that there's a difference between a voting bloc that purports to speak for the whole Democratic Party or purports to represent the center of gravity of the Democratic Party and a smaller, more tightly aligned, more disciplined, better organized voting bloc on the flank. But I think we can't kid ourselves about how big that one on the flank has to be in order to blunt the risks of vote shopping, which I think are pretty significant given the muscle memory that the Democratic establishment has about that as a successful response to their, you know, progressives being unruly from their perspective.
Final takeaways on Democratic leadership, Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi. Any final hot takes on how they've done? Keen observers of DC media will know that in September, actually the same day of the first hold, of the first holding of the line, there's reporting about a memo where Schumer and Manchin make a deal in the summer.
At the time that we signed that agreement, okay, and that was in July 28th. I was at that time asked to go to a budget resolution. I didn't think any of this was needed at this time. I thought that an infrastructure bill was really what was needed. But I said, fine, this is a condition I would get to. And that was a 1.5 because I looked at what the tax code, in a really competitive way, could basically spin off what we call hard dollars.
You signed that letter back in July. Why have you not been more clear about your priorities publicly, advocating for your priorities in that bill, given that it's moving anyway?
Well, you saw the bill.
I saw it.
And it pretty much lists a lot of good things.
Right, but you haven't said any of that in public.
I was trying to honor my agreement.
The reporter there is referencing a memo that both Senator Chuck Schumer and Joe Manchin signed on July 28th that sets a top line of $1.5 trillion. For the Build Back Better budget resolution. It includes other bad stuff about climate policy, cannot reduce fossil fuels, et cetera, et cetera. Was Chuck Schumer just going with the winds of his party, or is this a big mistake?
I mean, here's my take on that Schumer memo. I think that not telling folks the content of that memo was one of the biggest problems in this whole sequence.
Some have also called it a betrayal. I won't say who, but some people have called it a betrayal.
I mean, yeah. I think the fact that there was a predetermined timeline that anyone who was trying to build a successful arc was not in the know about is a waste of people's energy and smart strategic thinking. And my other take is that once you're in a position of leadership, I'm much less interested in what you personally support and far more interested in what you have a strategy to deliver. And there were a lot of moments throughout this fight where we heard a lot more about what Schumer personally supported and a lot less about what he had a plan to deliver. And I think that that memo really crystallized it, right? Because it's like Manchin signed the memo and then Schumer wrote into the bottom, I'm going to try to change Joe's mind about some of these things. But did he tell anybody that he signed this memo? Did he tell anybody that there was a preordained timeline? Did he tell anybody that there was a max dollar amount that we had to work with? No, he didn't do any of that. He just wrote this little CYA note into the bottom of the memo. So I think when it comes to leadership, it's like, what do you have a strategy to deliver? Much less important to me what you personally believe.
I mean, I feel like that covers everybody pretty well, that statement. When it comes to leadership, it's about the handshake. It's about the words people have behind closed doors and the gentlemen's agreements. And that's what we've been living on.
Any final takes on Team Biden? They've been driving the train from the opening gambit. Although I think they lost control of the train at some point. We could discuss when that is. They're no longer even going for their own messaging strategies. What do you make of it?
I think a couple of things. I think it was a huge mistake to try to break progressives. I mean, to try to break progressives at all, and particularly without any clearer commitment to legislative text than they had from Manchin. I think that was a huge strategic mistake. And at the same time, I do think that there are good and helpful things that President Biden can do if he like fully wields his executive authority that are still within his authority without having to go through Manchin. So like, I'm really disappointed by the way he handled legislative strategy. And I think that there are still good things that he can do in the rest of this Congress that we should be calling on him to do. Like, I don't think it serves us to like throw up our hands in despair and walk away from an expectation that President Biden deliver us, even though I'm really disappointed about the way that they handled legislative strategy.
Since we're doing Monday morning quarterbacking and we all enjoy tactics, I mean, is there a specific moment looking back at the timeline where you're like, okay, Joe Biden, if you're going to do this play, this was the moment or this was the window when you need to lock Joe Manchin in a room and agree on some ledge text before then you put pressure on people to pass Biff immediately? Like, when should that have happened?
After the first hold the line.
After
the first hold the line, when progressives proved that they were not willing to move Biff without BBB, that was the moment to be like, all right, team, roll up your sleeves. Let's get it done. Let's figure out how we're going to move both of these things together, which was, you know, supposedly a strategy that the president had blessed, that Pelosi had blessed.
And the progressives played their role. We blocked it. And it's like, go lock yourselves in a room and figure this out again.
I think that was the moment. And then obviously, like, that moment did not expire. They could have done that the next week or the next week. There was like a fair amount of time in there that they could have kicked off that process of taking ownership for landing the deal after progressives came in to be their muscle the first time. And instead, they didn't do that. And we ended up with like the second progressive flex. And then Biden deciding that the grasping at straws, feeling like his entire legislative agenda was in shambles. So he wanted to at least get Biff across the finish line and walk away with something. And so he was going to break the block that had been trying to defend a legislative pathway for his whole agenda for the last several months. I don't know, Amir, do you see a different point at which that should have happened?
My point would be earlier. My point would be definitely at that Rose Garden ceremony with the, like, I think it would have been at that point, like Manchin Cinema, I'm going to celebrate you. You guys are going to get the photo ops. You will get the accolades. We're going to get Biff. But I need assurances we're going to get this reconciliation bill and we're going to get that in writing. Like, that to me would have been the moment long, long before we even got to beyond August recess, because anybody knows that you can run the clock out after August, right? Like, I feel like that legislative, like, locking everything in should have happened that summer.
Okay, fine. I'm changing my answer to agree with Amira. I think after the first hold was the last good time that they had
the
to
last
fix it.
Good time.
Yeah, but Amira's totally right.
You should have already demanded that.
Yes,
and then
that's
there's
right.
The first
that's
hold.
Totally right.
Okay. But in
per
some
usual,
ways, yeah.
Amira coming in with the correct take.
After Manchin kills BBB in late December, which we haven't gotten to in the timeline, but at that point, I don't know, you know, what hand we had to play. Because Build Back Better is not passed in any form by the end of 2021, the expanded child tax credit that was passed in the American Rescue Plan and that families had begun receiving in 2021 expired. So in Jan 2022, those families stopped receiving the child tax credit. I want to end.
Wait, but can I just say something about the child tax credit?
For it, go
right.
For it.
So we basically had a 1 year run on this program, which was, as we talked about on a year ago when we did this, right? Democrats seized the tool of budget reconciliation, which is a tool designed for austerity, and like twisted it to use it for a progressive end, which is a child tax credit. But rather than structuring it like a tax credit, they structured it as monthly payments to parents. So it actually looked like an income support, more like the survival checks than like a traditional tax credit. Everything about that was good. But I think we actually, in some ways, did harm with the child tax credit. Not harm for the families who needed that support and got several months of it. I'm really glad that that happened, especially in a year that was so hard for so many families. But the thing that we talked about the last time that the three of us had this conversation was about this 1 year timeline on the child tax credit and how that's how you build constituencies for a new social program. You get folks used to a program, you build a constituency to fight for it, and then you fight for its continuation. And so we had it for 1 year, and now what we've taught people is the federal government is unreliable. It gives and takes away. There's no building of a constituency. There's no arc of the campaign to lock something into becoming permanent. There's a sense of precarity and instability. So not only did we not build that constituency and then win the thing to become permanent, I think we actually eroded people's sense that that's something that's possible on the child tax credit. And so I think that that's one area where my level of anger and rage.
This is a hot take.
Wow. That's true.
We are on very different spectrums. Oh, yeah.
Oh, tell me about it.
I think it was a sound concept, traditionally a sound political idea that you build a constituency and then it will be harder to take it away. I mean, it was a 6 month, like basically it was 6 months, right? It started in like, what, June officially and ended in December. I feel like because it was the one such glaringly good and politically good, it was good politics and good policy that nobody to this day understands why the F it is not in existence. And that is a political failure to the nth degree. And to me, actually just proves that we need different kinds of Democrats. And that's why I'm living in 2023, because I'm working on getting different kinds of Democrats. Can't do much on the Senate right now, but like fundamentally, it's a flaw of the Democratic Party of not understanding how to do politics.
Well, I'll just say, I think you and I actually agree, which is that it was a sound concept. But I mean, the level of failure of the Democrats in failing to deliver on what was a pretty basic blueprint that got handed to them is like, I mean, I agree. Maybe I'll just join you in 2023. Maybe that'll be better.
I'm like, girl, listen, I can't.
All right, before we never talk about this again, we're going to do a quick lightning round.
Okay.
Build Back Better is dead, but Democrats could still pass a budget reconciliation in the fiscal year 2022. Maybe it'll have some climate investments in it, drug reform. Now Manchin wants deficit reduction and also money for fossil fuels. Opening question, are Democrats going to pass anything decent through budget reconciliation this year? Yes or no? And second question, how do you feel about that?
Well, you know, I'm hanging out right there around the 50-50 split, although I will say to the question whether or not the Democrats will pass something that should earn a yes vote, I'm on the positive side of that. I wouldn't put like your savings on that prediction, but I lean yes. And how do I feel about that? Well,
Mary's like, don't gamble on this, but if I had to pick,
Listen, having worked with Congress for a while, my general recommendation is going to be do not put your savings on anything tied to what they may or may not do, because you might lose it all, and that would suck.
Nah, I'm going to come in with a hot take. Put all your money on them not doing shit. Put all your money. That's me. I'm a firm. They're not going to get anything done. And it's a safe bet. Put your money on that. Let's go. Let's go make some money.
And that means not only is Build Back Better dead, but it's like no package is going to get through budget reconciliation. Democrats are not going to get it together. They're not going to agree on something. And even if it does, it's going to be bad.
Yeah, that's my take.
All right. And the second opening question, how do you both feel about that? About you? What's the vibe check right now?
Go ahead, Mary.
I like how we're just going to hold down different ends of this continuum for this conversation. I mean, most of the time, I'm super pissed about what has happened over the last year and what I think is largely a squandered use of the last year. And also, you know, to keep waking up every day and doing organizing work on and off the Hill, most of the time I hang out a little closer to being even keeled because I can't run on rage forever. So I don't know, a little bit of moving around on the vibes here. What about you, Amira?
Well, I'm living in 2023, so I'm not even here. So I'm not even here anymore, okay?
You put down all of your savings on an outcome and left to go into next year where you've already cashed that year. In.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm not here right now. But no, I mean, I think what you said is about right, right? Like, I think that there is days where it's just, especially anytime I think about the child tax credit, that's when I'm filled with rage and just anger, just so much anger. But then I look at all of the different scenarios we were planning for November 2020 and the one where we did not have a Democratic trifecta. And I'm like, this is basically how I'm operating to think about this universe now that we are currently living in. I'm like, okay, the Senate has made it clear that they are not planning on doing anything for the American people. What can Biden do? What can we do in this reality moving forward? Because I can't keep chasing the ghost of BBB. It is, to me, it is dead. So I have moved on. I have mourned it. I have gone through my 5 stages of grief on it.
Okay. I got to cut you off because Mary's got to go soon. last question, a defense of Manchin, I want your response to. There are some moderate pundits who say, look, Manchin has been clear for months, one, that he doesn't like funding programs for 10 years and then they're going to expire. I know that our take is like, well, we don't want to do it through budget reconciliation anyways. So he's like, pick a few programs. And then there have constantly been these deals floated of like Manchin would do maybe some climate cash, pre-K, and this. Now it's climate plus all of the above, fossil fuels plus drug reform plus deficit reduction. I mean, is there criticism to be had, not just necessarily at progressives, maybe most of the Democratic mainstream handling this legislative process? Why didn't you guys cut down Build Back Better sooner and try to just give Manchin some 3 policy deal in December? Amira's rolling. Amira fell out of her seat with the eye roll.
My eyes have fallen out the back of my head as you're saying that. Listen, if this man had come to the rest of the Democratic Party and said, boop, 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 here's what it would take to get my yes vote, you've got it in writing, I'm good for it, that would be a real conversation to be had about whether or not folks walked away from a compromise that was offered, that was clear, and that they didn't take. That has never happened with this man. It has never happened. What he wants changes all the time, even when people draft the damn legislative text for him and bring it to him based on his news reports and like press conferences and I don't know, appearances on Fox News about what it is that he wants. And they draft it for him and are like, sir, is this it? Would you like to line edit this? He's like, actually, I've reconsidered my entire deal. He's a bad faith negotiator who has never been honest about what he will vote yes for. And also, if I can just say, the lack of imagination of this man, who could have gone to his colleagues and asked for literally anything on behalf of his constituents in West Virginia and probably would have gotten it. The fact that he hasn't, as the representative of West Virginia, asked for, I don't know, survival checks for every single one of his constituents, he probably could have gotten if he would have agreed to a robust Build Back Better, and hasn't had the integrity as a representative or a senator, never mind like actually a moral compass around policies to do that. The lack of imagination, the bad faith negotiation, all of it, I don't have any patience for a take that is progressives walked away from a compromise that was literally never on the table so far.
Boom.
Sorry.
Ladies and gentlemen, Mary Small, the National Legislative Director. Oh my God, Mary, wonderful to have you back on Group Chat. Be safe traveling to pick up your children in the District of Columbia.
Truly be safe.
Thank you again. Amira, wonderful as always. All right. That's the show. Thank you again to Mary and Amira for joining us. Thank you to our senior politics producer, Becca Rose, for working with Amira and Mary on this episode. Thank you to our new producer, Sophie Kapp. That's right, folks. We might even make more episodes faster. And thank you, as always, to our mix engineer, Rocky Russo. More soon. See you on the block.